Good morning. Welcome to the Roundtable panel, The Week in Review. I'm Madeline Reynolds, the associate producer of the Roundtable on WAMC. Each weekday morning, the Roundtable's Joe Donahue is joined by various experts, journalists, educators, and commentators to discuss current events. On Roundtable panel, The Week in Review, we feature selections from this week's shows. On Wednesday, August 14th, Joe Donahue was joined by Siena College Professor of Comparative Politics, Vera Icarius-Kelly, Dean of the College of Emergency Preparedness, Homeland Security, and Cybersecurity at the University at Albany, Robert Griffin, and Albany Law School Professor and Director of the Justice Center, Sarah Rogerson.
As recently as last month, U.S. intelligence officials warned that Iran aimed to stoke societal discord and undermine former President Donald Trump's bid to regain the White House. Reprise of its online interference 4 years ago. Now, the 2024 effort appears to have begun with suspected hacking attempts targeting the Republican and Democratic presidential campaigns. Intelligence officials, however, and disinformation experts remain unsure of the precise plan by Iran. The FBI is investigating suspected hacking by Iran targeting Trump associate Roger Stone, as well as advisors to the Biden-Harris campaign that use spear phishing emails, attempts to gain access to a target's communications by posing as a legitimate sender. That could have given intruders access to a vetting document prepared for the campaign on Senator J.D. Vance, Trump's running mate, that was sent to news organizations by an individual identifying himself only as Robert Bob.
So I have a theory about the name, Joe, is that if you look at the cryptology, and if you look at the issue of Bitcoin, the Dread Pirate Roberts is a name that has been used in sort of the black hat community. So I actually think the use of the name Robert is a tip to that. So anybody who hasn't read the Andy Greenberg books on Sandworm or any cyber, it's an interesting choice of names.
In an email with a Washington Post reporter, that person suggested his access to Trump campaign documents was distinct from the Iranian hacking effort. Federal law enforcement officials are trying to determine if the two events are connected. Well, that just muddies the waters, doesn't it?
Yeah. I mean, there's some irony here, too. So let's talk irony for a second. One, the very FBI that Trump wants to defund is, in charge of the investigation. Also, I think we'd be remiss if we didn't start this with a recollection about what happened in 2016, where Trump used the hacking of the Clinton campaign as a sign of organizational incompetence that made her unfit to be president. In fact, there's a situation where he actually called on Russia to hack the account. So there's a really interesting sort of background history here. One of the things that I will push back politely, these attacks though occurred on both political parties. The effort, I believe, from Tehran is to continue to undermine the people's confidence in our systems. I know right now this is being sort of portrayed as sort of Trump against the world and another example of his victimhood, but it's not. This was on both parties. It's also somewhat karma-ish that Roger Stone, of all people, was the person involved in it. I thought we had his stench out of American politics, but apparently he's still involved.
The U.S. officials warning that Iran was aiming to stoke societal discord. How can you tell? I mean, it just seems like we've been in societal discord for quite a while.
It doesn't take much.
No, right. Yeah, it's like how much do you have to add to that?
But that's an important point, though. But if it's, because the flame is so hot right now, it only takes a little more accelerant to again, fan the flames. And this will be used as part of the grievance when he loses the election. It will be because of the outside interference. It will be because the he'll at some point say that Harris is probably some sort of Iranian double agent, or this is the stuff that he will pull out, and his true believers will believe it.
The interesting thing is, that it was identified as an Iranian hacker right away, when I thought it's also possible it's Russians, it's also possible it's North Korean. I'm sort of, curious about that. We don't know any details. There has been just a mention of it's suspected to be Iranian. I don't know. I'm curious. I would like to know a little bit more about the backstory, and maybe we will hear about it. But it certainly is possible to have multiple countries involved in that and at the same time. And I think we have to just get used to the fact that certain regimes would like to really mess with Americans' beliefs in our system, as you said, Bob. I think this is the main idea. What they're doing in those countries, they have teams that permanently watch U.S. television stations, and based on the reporting and whatever journalists highlight, they interpret social conditions. So sometimes they're good at it and it works out, and sometimes they're overreaching. And in this case, they seem to have overreached because they have not actually all that much new information. They're recycling some of the information that was in the public sphere already. And I'm actually very happy that no journalists have disclosed the dossier or the information that was sent, because it just would have created sort of this other sort of cycle of negative responses. So number one, I'm not sure if it's only Iran. I think there are multiple potential actors, and I'd like to have more information about if it was Iran, what their actual plan is. Because creating chaos may be somewhat helpful, but, I'm not sure if the Iranians really have clarity here in terms of why they go for certain interferences.
Sarah? Everyone should be locking down their cyber presence. This is the one we know about mm-hmm. today.
Yep.
Leading up to November, there will be more mm-hmm. from all external and internal actors within the country. I mean, we have mm-hmm. some of the most sophisticated cyber criminals right here in the good old US of A. So it's time to start locking down everything in a much more responsible way.
Yeah, and your point about Russian interference is really interesting, and there is a lot of intel that points to nexus of cooperation between the GRU, the Russian mm-hmm. Secret Service. Russia has also turned hacking over to their own organized crime units, which have this sort of weird governmental mm-hmm. independent relationship. You get North Korea, and you start to think about this, the axis of funding of weaponry into uh-huh. Ukraine with Russia yep. and Iran and China and North Korea. You see it coming together. Now, the cynical side of me says that they purposely didn't call out Russian interference mm-hmm. in part because I think that if you look at where money is flowing into campaigns, yep. that there is more support for a Trump campaign from Russia than there would be for right. Harris. Mm-hmm. The other cynical part of me, though, Joe, says that given the fact that the war drums are beating really loudly in the Middle East right now, with sort of waiting with bated breath for some sort of attack from Iran on Israel, that this right. that this is also sort of almost an Orwellian prelude to setting up anger in the United States at Iran for interfering yeah. into politics. So there's sort of a multidimensional elements of mm-hmm. this that I'm kind of playing with.
So you mentioned something that I also thought about, very interesting, sort of because the Russians get drones from Iran. And maybe there's some kind of a deal, drones for hacking support. I mean, there are all kinds of things that are happening all the time between those countries because they are increasingly economically marginalized. At least, the populations are suffering tremendously, well, not the elites. But I mean, there is a potential both in Iran and in Russia for some regional unrest again.
Well, and if you think there isn't a direct, I'm in a PSA kind of mood, but if you don't think that there's a link between your social media consumption and your news consumption and what is tracked on your computer through your IP uh-huh. address and your browser history and what's happening in this big story that seems immense and sort of something that an individual might feel detached from, mm-hmm. it's directly related. Mm-hmm. Every single thing that you do online on a computer, whether it's work or personal or a combination of both, which is messy, is feeding into this system. Mm-hmm. So, you know, just a reminder to pay attention to where you're getting your news from. And Facebook is not the best place for that.
Or social media in general, period. I think.
Bob, I had read a piece maybe a day and a half ago, so I don't know how relevant it is now. But my understanding was initially, at least on part of the hacking, which may not have been the Iranian part, but as far as the some of the spear phishing that was done, that seemed to affect the Trump campaign more because they actually opened the emails versus the Harris campaign that seemed to be
slow in opening emails.
Did not open the emails, right? Yes. Did identified them, put them aside, and said these are things that we don't want to open.
Yeah, and you know, this is a message to my provost too. Like those emails that I haven't opened from you, it's just because I'm concerned about spear phishing.
Oh, absolutely, 100%.
I think that's it. I think that's exactly right. And you know, back to Sarah's point about you know just good cyber hygiene. You have to really pay attention, and it's hard because I've had issues where I've been spearfished, and I mean it was just for dumb luck that I didn't contaminate the systems.
So for people who do not know, explain what spearfishing is.
So basically, what it is that a hacker will take over an identity of someone who is known to you. And then send a link and embed it in an email to you, and you open it up thinking, oh hey Vera, I haven't heard from her. How's she doing? You know, and I open up and all of a sudden I realize it's not Vera at all, and that there is now a virus that's in the system that is opening up my emails and my system's emails to the hacker's control. So it's not the, you know, I'm not making fun of people who fell under the Nigerian prince scam or the scams, which was sort of a more of a blast a spam attempt. The spear phishing is really sophisticated. And it's, you actually have to go in and look specifically at the address that's underneath the name that's showing in the email to see. So in a situation where I get something from you, Joe, that says, you know, it's, you know, your email at WAMC.org or whatever the email address is, I have to click on that to make sure that's what it says underneath. Because if it says, you know, Joey Gubu from Gmail underneath it, it means that didn't come from you.
Right.
Yeah. So I've actually been spearfished on Facebook Messenger where I hadn't been in touch with somebody for a long time, and it was somebody who was like an older colleague of mine who retired 10 years ago, and all of a sudden I got a message, and I thought, oh my gosh, I haven't heard from you in so long, and I did a response, and then I was thinking after a couple of exchanges, I was like, well, that's a strange conversation. That doesn't really sound like the person I know, and then I just discontinued, you know, but it's scary when you're thinking, oh my God, it took like two or three little exchanges before you actually realize this was not the person you thought it was.
So we have this letter from John who says, it seems to me that if the best the hacker could come up with is J.D. Vance's vetting process, then they failed miserably. Why bother releasing that? Well, we don't really know, do we?
No, we don't know what they have. We don't know what they have released or not released. I think, you know, yesterday I was complimenting Joe on yesterday's panel. I thought it was a really interesting conversation. Mm-hmm. You could see some divergence among the roundtable members yesterday, mm-hmm. but the idea of the press's responsibility and what does a responsible journalist do or release with information? And I think this is a struggle that we're seeing from places like Politico and New York Times and Washington Post. And despite of all the slings and arrows against the mainstream media, I think the mainstream media has actually gone out of its way to not elevate illegitimately gained information. Mm-hmm. Which becomes sort of a real question, right? Mm-hmm. Of ethics.
So the only information that we know has been disclosed is because some of the media have talked about what was sent by Robert, right? Robert guy, or person, or identity, and there might be a whole host of other bits of information they've collected and released to people that we haven't heard from, that are thinking about how to use it. I mean, there's a lot of sort of obscured bits of details that we have no idea about.
In the Washington Post, there's an article about this, and for some reason, someday I'll understand why it's in the style section. But true. An alleged Iranian hacking operation. They say so far newsrooms have been reluctant to run with the material. Over the past few weeks, reporters at Politico, The Washington Post, and The New York Times received emails from a mysterious figure offering internal Trump campaign documents, most notably a 271-page listing J.D. Vance's potential vulnerabilities as a running mate. The FBI is now investigating, but that question of newsrooms being reluctant to run with it, and I guess if it's obvious that you don't, and we did discuss this yesterday with Judy and Terry Gibson, as well as Mark Whitman, that the question is, okay, so you have a pseudonym offering internal documents of questionable news value, what do you do with that? And I think the answer is, like, you wait, right? You turn over to the FBI and see what happens.
The cynical side of me says that anything that hackers could have about J.D. Vance's idiosyncrasies and weaknesses have been on stunning full display ever since he was nominated. I mean, he has no problem getting up there a la natural, showing everybody why he is incompetent. He has to be considered one of the worst initial choices for vice presidential candidate since Palin. I mean, although he's making Palin, Sarah Palin look very, very smart right
poised.
Now.
Poised, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, that's also, the hackers may have thought they had something special, showing all of the deficiencies of J.D. Vance until he got up and mm-hmm. started to open his mouth.
Or I'm sort of, let's think about this. I think there's a possibility that Trump will dump Vance as the VP and there might be something to that idea and create, get somebody new. I mean, it's possible, right?
I thought that we were at the point that they were locked in with him because of
ballots
because ballots have already started to.
Are they beginning to print ballots now? Over? Okay.
Yeah,
okay.
I thought so. And I mean, that would have then Trump would have to admit that he doesn't hire and promote the best
people. It was advised to him. He didn't really. It doesn't matter what. He just insists and then it happens.
Well, I don't even think it matters what information surfaces about J.D. Vance to the people who are dead set on voting in favor of the Trump-Vance ticket. I don't think it matters. Trump has been convicted of crimes that were surfacing during the last election, and his supporters don't care.
That was Sarah Rogerson on the Roundtable panel on Wednesday, August 14th. We'll be back with more after this break. We'll be right back. Welcome back to the Roundtable Panel, The Week in Review. On Thursday, August 15th, Joe Donahue was joined by public policy and communications expert Teresa Bourgeois, Chief of Staff and Vice President for Strategy and Policy at Bard College, Malia Dumont, publisher emeritus of the Daily Freeman, Ira Fussfeld, and Vice President for Editorial Development at the New York Press Association, Judy Patrick.
The big news before we talk about Trump is that this broke yesterday around 8:39 o'clock last night, where Nemat Shafik, the president of Columbia University, has resigned. And this is after a long battle back and forth. Resigned Wednesday after months of far-reaching fury over her handling of pro-Palestinian demonstrations and questions over her management of a bitterly divided campus. She was the third leader of an Ivy League university to resign in about 8 months, following maligned appearances before Congress about anti-Semitism on their campuses. Elise Stefanik tweeting last night, "One down, everyone else to go." Dr. Shafik is an economist who spent much of her career in London, and in a letter, and I believe goes by Manoush.
That's my understanding.
Yes, Manoush. So if you think I just didn't know that. But anyway, an economist who spent much of her career in London said in a letter to the Columbia community that while she felt the campus had made progress in some important areas, it had also been a period of turmoil where it has been difficult to overcome divergent views across our community. All right, so let us begin with the chief of staff of a college and as to your thoughts on this story, Malia.
Yeah, well, I mean, the headline says it's unexpected, and it's hard to know if it's unexpected within the Columbia community. There's a lot we don't know about how this came about. But what we do know is, like last spring, before the congressional testimony, she and Columbia were lifted up as examples, and before things really got out of hand, of good management of what seemed to be not yet a crisis, but certainly a difficult time of relations between the university and its students. And that that devolved as the situation in Columbia really got out of control. A lot of outsiders came in, and there was the students took over buildings, and students from other universities started going there to get training on how to expand this kind of movement. She survived that. She survived the congressional testimony, which didn't look good for anyone who participated in it. There are a couple reasons we could think about. Why is she resigning now? It's possible that there's been discontent within the Board of Trustees of Columbia about her leadership, and they have been wanting to move on. That's one possibility, and she decided to resign because of that. Another possibility, I think, is actually there's a high likelihood of this, is that she's someone who wanted to be a leader at the university and then was sucked into this situation and looked at the semester coming up and thought, I don't want to continue to deal with this. I mean, students are going to be coming back soon. And a lot of university leaders, I think, they're crisis management is not their background.
Right.
That it's not something that that anyone really looks forward to in most cases, and it doesn't look like a fulfilling or job opportunity anymore, and not really doing the work maybe that she expected to be doing. So it's possible that that's what motivated this sort of unexpected resignation as well.
Not saying that this is what happened at all, but you could see, just as you outlined, where you finish up the semester and you say, okay, let me see the dust settle.
Yeah.
And see how things, where we are, and then go forward, and then suddenly turn the page of the calendar and go, oh God.
Well, she also had a job lined up. And the story in the paper in the Times, and I don't remember where it is, but she has a job she is going to. Might be in England, but
yes, it is. Yes, yeah. To go to London, yes. Judy.
So look at this from two different levels. From the kids headed off to Columbia this week, packing their bags, going into the dorms. Do they care? No, they probably don't care. But from a higher level, you see the Republicans continuing to attack higher education. I mean, the fact that did Lee Stefanik really tweet that? One down or three down?
I'll get the. Yes, I'll get the
I thought she tweeted that like when the first one resigned.
Right.
She
did last night. Yeah. So the attack on higher education is one that's has always mystified me because in this country we tended to value education, but I still remember having Tea Party people come into my office when I was the editor of a newspaper, and their big complaint to me was that I was too educated. So you know, I think. Remember Donald Trump saying on the stump, maybe it was in the 2016 election, he loves the uneducated. If you're uneducated, you're not discerning. You can't make differentiate between truth and fact.
The actual quote was three down, so many to go.
Yeah, that's so higher education is something we should value in this country, and it's something that increasingly has come under attack by the far right.
Well, with a couple of caveats, I would say the following. First of all, I'm a big believer in student protests. It's part of the great tradition of academia in this country. It didn't start with this most recent event. I can recall when I was in New Paltz in the late 60s, there were protests, and it was a regular part of the being on the campus. But it gave the students an opportunity to start molding ideas, and some of them took it too far and by taking over buildings and offices, and some of them will learn from, all of them, I think, will learn from the experience. And I don't object. I would not be among those who was critical of a college president who is trying to allow the students to exercise their free speech rights and their academic credentials or their academic learning. The caveats are, well, you don't want anybody to get hurt. You don't want the physical plant to be damaged. You want people of all sides to be able to walk on campus and feel that they're not going to get hit on the head with a baseball bat. And
10 seconds.
I think that this college president and all college presidents have got it tougher today, much like we all have it tougher today making decisions.
Resignation of the Columbia president, Manoush Shafiq, that was announced yesterday after the turmoil on campuses this spring. Is there anything additional that you wanted to mention, Ira, before?
No, I'm worn out.
Okay, yeah, I can understand that. Teresa Bourgeois.
Yeah, well, even though it was a surprise announcement, it appeared basically from her resignation letter that this was long in the making. I mean, the UK, as you noted, Ira, UK Foreign Secretary, and this is from her departure letter, had invited her to chair a review of the government's approach to international development and how to improve capabilities. She had been at the London School of Economics. She's going back to London and to continue her work, as she says, on fighting global poverty and promoting sustainable development areas. And I find this attack on universities so disturbing, and as you note, an attack on use of your freedom of speech. You know, she talks about her core values and principles that are dear to her: academic freedom, free speech, openness to ideas, zero tolerance for discrimination of any kind, including gender, race, religion. If you step back and listen to what Trump has said, what's in the platform, what's posted on his site, what he says in his speeches, and what's in Project 2025 about education in general and higher education. They're talking about the dismantling of the education department and particularly removing any reference to DEI,
diversity, equity, inclusion.
Thank you. Diversity, equity, inclusion. And there's clearly the Republicans, as the party is configured now, has a real concern about that, about any sorts of diversity and freedoms, freedom of speech. I think that Elise Stefanik, I don't know if this is where it originated, but She is a graduate of Harvard and was on the Kennedy School Board of a Kennedy School Board of Advisors at Harvard. And after she did not denounce the or after denouncing what happened on January 6th, she then agreed with Trump about the election. You know, she's an election denier. And so she was removed from that advisory committee. And maybe it's causal, maybe it's not, but it seems that she got much more vocal after that and this attack on presidents. And it seems a bit, I don't know, unseemly is the word that comes to my mind. But if on the, you know, the Trump gave this economic speech and you're talking about how to revive the economy, well, you can't do that without universities, right? And you need the science, you need the research, you need training people. And, you know, what's the long-term, what is the long-term goal here in going after universities and trying to discredit universities? Short-term goal, maybe they think with the Jewish community in this, you know, case, they get some public, political support. But what's the long-term goal in attacking universities?
John writes to us and says, conservatives think education equals indoctrination. Because to conservatives, indoctrination is education. Conservatives don't teach, they indoctrinate and always have. Actually, teaching people have to think, which is the entire purpose of a university, shouty caps, and is what they were founded for, objectively terrifies conservatives and always has. That from John. Rick says, I beg to differ with Teresa's comments that America values education. Though most of us educated people really do, it is pretty common knowledge that in general, throughout history, working class Americans have been suspicious of educated people. They are mocked in cinema and rarely ever looked up to. It's sad, I know, but it seems pretty true. Then we go to Joan. Dr. Shafiq's resignation follows on the heels of the resignation of three deans who were found to engage in anti-Semitic texting. I don't know anything. I didn't read.
Oh, yeah. That was really terrible.
Right. At Columbia.
Yeah, they were in full view. I mean, they were just not very careful. In full view of people. They were sitting in an auditorium attending an event and texting each other things that were clearly derogatory. So they were put on administrative leave, and now they've all left.
Anybody? Okay. Then we go to, to Harv, who says, after showing callous disregard for the safety of Jewish students on campus and losing control of the blatant anti-Semitism shown by some members of the Columbia University faculty, and for losing control of the campus to pro-Palestine rioters, the president of the Ivy League college has resigned. This shows once again that vigilance against anti-Semites and those who want to trample on Israel are being watched, and that there will be legal, peaceful, and justified consequences for them. As a master's graduate of Teachers College, Columbia University, I could not be happier. That from Harv. Then we go to this letter. I don't know who said it, but I'm disturbed that I did not hear anyone push back on the comment that the uneducated, quote unquote, are unable to be discerning. That's insulting to many people on many levels. My late father had a high school education and was firmly blue collar, and he was one of the most discerning thinkers I have ever known. He read newspapers and watched the network evening news, and he would have hated Fox News and all its evil spawn. Please avoid those generalizing comments that put the uneducated into the, quote, basket of deplorables. I don't recall anyone.
I don't either, but I've long said on this air and elsewhere that I think the people who believe the far right, the MAGA people, the Trump supporters are stupid, are not the people on the left, but it's the leaders of the MAGA movement. It's Trump, because all they do is feed their followers lies and misinformation, and they expect them not to be discerning.
I'm the guilty one on the uneducated comment because what we're primarily focused on is formal education. I mean, that is it's the higher education part of it. I think if you're watching the news and you're reading the newspapers, you're not uneducated. You are educating yourself. But what we're seeing from the far right again is capitalizing on the fact that there are people who do not discern between fact and fiction, and they're easily led and they're easily indoctrinated, as an earlier writer noted. Going into higher education does teach you to be more tolerant, I think. That's something I learned in college, is tolerance and the fact that there are different kinds of people in the world. It's not something you often get just through high school, or if you only went through eighth grade, which there are a lot of people in this country that only completed education through eighth grade. So you're not aware of how government operates in many instances. I'm not generalizing about it. There are people who do not get a formal education that can be discerning, but by and large, if you haven't learned about how systems operate, how different people in the world live, you are more apt to be indoctrinated.
I do agree. I mean, I think you can make a distinction between uninformed and uneducated. I think those are two separate things, and I do think you can become an educated, informed outside of a formal, college education structure. And a lot of people I know who don't have college degrees are very wise and learn a lot in their, in their areas of endeavor. I think there are lots of ways to get educated, and maybe that's what the person is talking about. But I do think that there's another layer of this, and one of the writers talked about it, and I think it went for the university president. I don't know this for sure, but some of the things I read about her and some of the statements she talked, some of what she talked about in her statement, there was also, a fair level of threats against her and her family. And I think that we've seen that with universities, we've seen that with judges, we've seen that with election officials. We've seen that across the board now. And I think that this is a piece of this puzzle that we've seen since 2016. It's not that it didn't exist before, but it's really magnified, and there needs to get a handle on this, because people should not be at risk, should not have to leave their homes. I'm not suggesting, but I think about the funny situation and the prosecutor in Atlanta who's had to leave her home and move every couple of months because her life is at risk. And this has got to stop.
I think the listener who wrote in about the historical aspects of this was pretty astute. So there is an anti-intellectual strain that runs throughout American history. I don't think it's necessarily anti-education.
Right.
It's more of a class-based critique of American society, where educational institutions are often seen as being very elitist, and not so that it may be hard in some cases to draw a distinction between the education you receive at some institutions and the institution itself. But I think a lot of the concern among even some moderate Republicans is about the way the institutions are being managed, and what that means for the kind of education you're receiving there. And it's relatively easy to capitalize on that from a political perspective, because there is such a history of that kind of anti-elitist strain, particularly in more conservative circles.
But isn't that because of the exclusivity? Isn't it that all the more reason why you need diversity, particularly economic diversity in these universities, which they've been trying to move toward? I mean,
and ideological diversity
and
as well.
Ideological diversity, all the range of diversities are needed, and it's finally opening up a bit.
That was Teresa Bourgeois on the Roundtable panel on Thursday, August 15th. We'll be back with more of the Roundtable panel The Week in Review after this. We'll be right back. Welcome back to the Roundtable Panel, The Week in Review. On Friday, August 16th, Joe Donahue was out of the office, so Sarah LaDuke hosted the Roundtable Panel, and she was joined by public policy and communications expert Teresa Bourgeois, Tetherless World Professor of Computer Web and Cognitive Sciences at RPI Jim Hendler, and Senior Fellow at the Center for Civic Engagement at Bard College Ambassador Fred Hoff.
Updates on the Russian and Ukraine conflict. Russian troops are closing in on the strategic city in Ukraine, an eastern Ukrainian town of Pokrovsk, according to open-source battlefield maps, casting doubts on Ukraine's hopes that its new offensive into western Russia will prompt Moscow to scale back its attacks elsewhere on the battlefield. Russian forces are about 8 miles from the city, one of Ukraine's main defensive strongholds in the Donetsk region, according to the maps, which are based on combat footage and satellite images. This coming a day after we heard that Ukrainian troops took full control of the Russian town of Sudzha. President Volodymyr Zelensky said yesterday that would be Ukraine's first capture of a Russian urban center since its troops launched a surprise attack into the country 10 days ago. Sudzha is a small town about 6 miles from the border. It quickly fell into the path of Ukrainian troops sweeping into Russian territory over the past week, and military experts have said in recent days that Ukrainian forces had seized most, if not all, of the town. The capture of Sudzha could further lift the spirits of Ukrainian civilians and soldiers who have already been buoyed by Kyiv's daring and so far relatively successful incursion after months of losing ground at home. So that was the news yesterday, and then the news this morning or overnight that Russia is taking towns that they maybe hadn't before. How does this all look right now? We'll start with you, Fred.
Yeah, I think the notwithstanding the Ukrainian success in this incursion, which is indeed very heartening, the salient fact is still in eastern Ukraine, where Russian forces are pressing against Ukrainian defenders. The Russians have a manpower advantage of about 5-1. All right, it would seem that the Ukrainian incursion into Russia is aimed at trying to force the Russians to divert forces from their positions in eastern Ukraine. It's a little bit early to assess whether or not that's going to be successful. I suspect, even though this has been extraordinarily embarrassing for Russian President Vladimir Putin, I suspect his best course of action is to contain this incursion as best he can without diverting a lot of forces and continue to press in eastern Ukraine. The Russians still enjoy a significant artillery advantage, something that ultimately will be evened out a bit. The United States and other Western countries are providing additional resources, but it takes time for these things to get into the country. And the best estimates I've seen suggest that that the Ukrainians will have something approaching sufficient artillery shells sometime in the fall or winter. So, good operation, surprise operation. American and Western weaponry has come in very handy in this thing, but whether it's going to alter the basic demographic facts on the ground, probably too early to tell.
Yeah, I would say that there've been two things that haven't yet been verified completely, but that are interesting. One is that apparently what Russia has done is they're sending, their third string team in. So the group that's going to fight the current Ukrainian thing are essentially almost untrained Russian soldiers who are being rushed into the battle. So in a sense, Russia can do what it can to keep that down while still keeping its main forces where they are. So I agree with you on that. The other thing that was mentioned was that Ukraine has now made some drone strikes very deep into Russia. And I think, you know, that's being downplayed a lot because, again, the Putin response. But it's sort of saying, you know, if you're going to bomb Kyiv, we can hit Moscow. We haven't done it yet, but, you know, we have that capability. So I think there's a lot going on here, which often happens in these kind of things, where strategic things are being done that have more to do with looking for an end game, looking for a way out, looking for something. But this one, you know, I just don't. The only potential easy end game I see is a Republican takeover in the U.S. that basically just shuts Ukraine out of our funding, and then, you know, it becomes Western Europe's best chance, and that's hard. That's going to be hard without us. Pulling out of NATO would be the most insane thing we could possibly do, and we have a presidential candidate who's been wanting us to do that for a long time.
Which one? So. Just kidding.
I know on the radio we can't endorse anyone, but I do know that we could criticize, and I'm very happy to criticize. But it's not just the Trump campaign. It's the strong Republican support that he's able to get. So, you know, if the Republicans take the House or the Senate, then the problem becomes even with a Democratic president, you can veto things, but it's very hard to push things through. Teresa, you probably know way more about that than I do.
Yeah, well, actually, in preparing for this, I figured that on the ground it would be Fred talking about this, but I wanted to really understand what the bigger picture of where we're going because we're so close to the election. And I found what I thought was a fascinating story by Michael Hirsch in Politico. It was written July 2nd, 2024, and I highly recommend it. Trump's plan for NATO is emerging. And it was a deep dive into the people who had been his national security advisors in the last administration, those he continues to surround himself with, and where they are on these issues and so where they think Trump is going to be. And they call for a quote-unquote radical reorientation in which Washington takes the backseat to Europe and cuts a deal with Putin over Ukraine. And this is, you know, Trump's been signaling this for a while, and J.D. Vance is signaling this. And interestingly, J.D. Vance has been talking about how, you know, young people, he hasn't said, seem to be gravitating toward Harris, but he says, you know, the young people, they should be concerned about do you want to go to war or not, because we're not going to send you to war to fight other people's wars, which is, I think, you know, sort of all things. But it really talks about how he will talk about getting out of NATO, but he won't completely get out of NATO because he can't. But he will push for what they call a two-tiered system. So if you paid your full 2%, you get more coverage than you don't, which would end with Article 5, which basically says any NATO members will come and support you, right? And so that would obliterate the Article 5. And it talks about how it really will shift all of the, you know, on the ground support away from the U.S. and with the expectation that European countries handle that, which they don't have the capacity to do, and that the U.S. would really just focus on more cybersecurity and intelligence and those kinds of things. But they are calling for a complete reorientation. So that's one of the things I was curious and concerned about, because it would certainly, and they say it's for the purpose of strengthening our focus on China, but it seems to me that there's so much interconnectedness now that it would only the unintended consequences would be to weaken our position against China, because it's better to come in as a, you know, alliance than it is alone. But you're the...
Yeah, no, look, if the United States is seen by Beijing as basically folding up on Ukraine, inevitably the Chinese will draw conclusions about the willingness of the United States to defend Taiwan, okay? And you know, in that kind of a situation, it's very, 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 very dangerous. One of the things that I find encouraging about recent policy shifts in the current administration, and Jim alluded to this, is the willingness of the United States to see the Ukrainians using our weapons to strike targets in Russia. In my personal view, and I suspect this is the case in terms of policy, I think the main thing we're telling the Ukrainians now is under no circumstances should you imitate Putin by targeting civilian populations.
Yeah.
You know, you want to smack a Russian airbase? Go for it.
And that's what they're doing here, right?
Before
that's
drone
what
they're doing strikes or Royal Air Force.
Now
bases,
they're using drones quite effectively.
And they created a humanitarian corridor right away, right? In this incursion into the community, the towns, they created, I guess, several towns, but they created immediately humanitarian corridors and in returning the Russian soldiers who were killed back to Russia.
But this policy shift on our part has been a long time coming. And in my opinion, it's welcome. It gives the Ukrainians a chance to defend their own civilians from from Russian terror attacks.
Can I say one other thing on this Politico article, if it's all to be believed? It seemed pretty well researched. But the other thing is that many of the people that they interviewed for this, who have been surrounding him and who were with him before, are the architects of the foreign policy portions of Project 2025. So, can I say another the Jim Hendler question?
Go do your thing, Teresa.
Because I've been wondering when they were talking about Ukraine, right? This offensive that they just had, they talked about how they were able to pierce their air coverage. So with because they had satellite information, is that still are they still using Starlink? Is that still Elon Musk, or do you know?
I don't know, but I don't think so. I mean, I think Elon. So Starlink was providing primarily the equivalent of internet broadband type coverage, right? And the military had been using it. I think when Musk shut that off, they moved to a multiple communication thing. I think what that really impacted, and again, this is mostly inference from things we've read, is to understand that a lot of what we have always seen as Russian cyber attacks and Russian cyber criminals, ransomware, et cetera, were actually Russian-funded groups who lived in Ukraine or who worked from Ukraine. It was easier to work for Ukraine for various reasons, having to do with the politics, et cetera, how the internet connectivities work, how you can trace things. So shutting down Starlink did make a big impact on so when the war started, all those Ukrainians who had been attacking us went back to attacking Russia. So Russia actually built their own enemy force, strangely enough. When Starlink was shut down, that did seriously impact the cyber attacks on Russia. And I don't know if that's been restored. I don't know what's going on because, you know, it's really hard to get any information on what's underneath this. But, for example, when you get a drone to an Air Force base well inside a country, that means you have somehow bypassed some of the intelligence. How that happens, well, first of all, it's classified even if you were allowed to know. But in fact, a lot of that discussion happens within each of the countries. So you know, I don't know that the U.S. would even know exactly how Ukraine is doing that.
It seemed that this incursion really exposed a weakness on the part of the Russians, right? I mean, they're not taking a big part of a land, but the fact that they were able to get in, isn't that, Fred? I mean,
yeah, Russian defenses were weak, but this is a real roll of the dice.
Yeah.
Because, again, the key fact is 5-1 personnel disadvantage on the part of Ukraine. I don't know exactly how many troops are involved in this incursion, but they are coming, right out of the Ukraine's defensive posture. So this is not without risk.
We were talking about Starlink and learned some stuff about that during the break. Jim, can you update us?
Yeah. So one of the things that I must admit I wasn't aware of until I started looking carefully to answer Teresa's question, is actually the Pentagon apparently has been funding Musk to provide Starlink.
So for people who don't know Starlink, why don't you explain
what
Starlink
is? I'm sorry. So Starlink is...
I realize I didn't do that. Sorry.
A satellite-based internet system. So here in the U.S., most of our broadband goes through wires, cables, optical cables, et cetera. And so when we talk about extending broadband coverage to rural communities, we're really talking about a physical creation. Now, in a lot of the countries that didn't put that investment in, they've moved instead to what's called a mobile internet. In some cases, a lot of Africa, a lot of South America, you know, essentially think of it as your cell phone becomes your primary internet connection. And they're using not exactly the same cell phone technology, but similar cell phone technology to us. Starlink is the next step up. You have a set of satellites going around, which basically, when I send a message on my thing, the internet takes it up to the to a satellite and back down again, and these satellites can communicate with each other. And then, you know, again, I'm not going to get into a two-hour lecture on networking, but the key thing is that Musk runs the company Starlink that put these up and is providing coverage to a number of countries, including Ukraine. So much of the Ukrainian internet capabilities come through Starlink. Now, at one point, I believe it was back in March of this year, the Ukrainians were starting to do some drone attacks, and Starlink got shut down, and there's a lot of debate over exactly how and why. But interestingly, some of the articles I was just looking at say that was Musk's way of forcing the Pentagon to give him more money.
That was Jim Hendler on the Roundtable panel on Friday, August 16th. Full episodes of the Roundtable panel are available online at wamc.org/roundtable. This has been this week's Roundtable panel, The Week in Review. I'm Madeline Reynolds. Thank you for listening.